everyone, and welcome to this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. This is the Friday, September 23rd edition. It's brought to you here on the morning of Saturday, September 24th. Hope you're having a good one, everyone. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. This is Andrew Haupt, your reader, filling in this morning. Well, looking at the Mason City Globe Gazette, the front page, the headlines, 400,000 Iowans to see student loan debt cut. Out of the Globe Gazette Des Moines Bureau, a story by Caleb McCullough. Also, 1133rd preparing for deployment in Manly. The Army National Guard unit moves gear via railway operation. And there are some photos there. We'll talk about that here soon, along with the headline, Daabin, or D-A-A-B-I-N, opens in Mason City. This store sells overstock, return discontinued items from big retailers. But before we go any further, we'll take a check of the forecast for today and the next several days here in the Mason City Globe Gazette for the northern Iowa area. And for your Saturday today, expect a nice day, breezy and warmer conditions as compared to yesterday. A high of 71 degrees, those winds rather mild out of the west and northwest, up to 16 miles per hour. Again, a high of 71 degrees for your Saturday. For tonight, Saturday night into Sunday morning, expect a low of 48 degrees. On Sunday, expect windy conditions with lots of sun. Those winds gusty up to 25 miles per hour. It'll be out of the north and northwest. High of 70 degrees, much like today. And then for your Monday, cooler yet, a high of 68 degrees, sunshine and breezy. And then Tuesday, plenty of sunshine, winds out of the north and northwest, high of just 63 degrees, but sunny on Tuesday. So expect a nice few days in store as we get this fall season and the first full week of fall started off here in northern Iowa. And this is Andy bringing this to you from central Iowa, where we're seeing pretty much the same, maybe a few degrees warmer each and every day. We're kind of on a different lateral than you all. But moving on here to the story. In the front page, 1133rd, preparing for deployment in May. And the photo shows railway workers and Army National Guard members preparing equipment to be transported by train. That was on Tuesday, as they have several Army vehicles up on top of those train flatbeds, train cars. And the photo below, a smaller photo, shows Brigadier General Stephen Osborne speaking to service members that loaded up the equipment to be transported out of Manly on Tuesday. The story by Abby Koch of the Globe Gazette and begins, if you passed through Manly recently, you might have noticed a fleet of military vehicles. That is because the Army National Guard's 1133rd Transportation Company is preparing to go on deployment. This is one of the steps we have to take to get our equipment ready to get shipped out, said Staff Sergeant Randy Hakes. Servicemen and railway workers were loading equipment on rail cars Tuesday. Hakes called it a circus method where vehicles and equipment are moved down the track and then secured. It is one of the largest railroad operations in 20 years. When we go on this mission, we will be on an active duty mission, but still National Guardsmen, said Captain Seth Van Steenwick. The equipment requirements to go on Title 10, which is active Army, makes it so all this equipment had to be inspected and certified. The only practical way to move this big of equipment is by train, he said. Well, Hakes and Master Sergeant Trista Stengel have been organizing the move since early this year. Stengel says she has been more of the computer side, while Hakes has been the muscle. We did a lot of fast planning, and there were a lot of different changes, Stengel said. Equipment was loaded onto trains Tuesday and will begin again Wednesday. We can say we are going to Europe and taking a whole unit, said Hakes. Van Steenwick said all of the soldiers will be able to connect with families and there will be good living conditions. The soldiers will be well taken care of on this deployment. It will really be a really proud mission to serve on, said Van Steenwick. Stengel said they have not deployed all of the 1133rd unit equipment since the early 2000s. Since that time, not a lot of people have used the railroad to move equipment. With all of the different ins and outs and people coming in and out of the Army, it's a big deal because a lot of us nowadays haven't seen the equipment move on rail, said Stengel. The operation received a visit from high-ranking officers, including Brigadier General Stephen Osborne. It gives them a big overview. They were really worried about this. This task is kind of dangerous, and there's never been this type of railroad operations for quite a while, said Hakes. It's pretty new to them, too, and safety is a huge concern. And that ends this story. However, no further details were given where they are going. Maybe we'll find out someday. 400,000 Iowans to see student debt cut. Student loan debt cut. This is written by Caleb McAuliffe of the Globe Gazette Des Moines Bureau, Dateline Des Moines, where more than 400,000 Iowa borrowers are expected to see their student loan debt reduced or erased under Joe Biden's debt forgiveness plan, according to estimates from the White House released Tuesday. According to a White House fact sheet, 408,700 Iowa borrowers will see some federal student loan debt forgiven. Of those borrowers, 248,900 are Pell Grant recipients and are eligible for up to $20,000 in debt forgiveness. Other borrowers are eligible for up to $10,000 in debt forgiveness. Biden announced the debt forgiveness plan in August, announcing borrowers making less than $125,000 a year or less than $250,000 for married couples would be eligible for up to $10,000 in loan forgiveness or $20,000 for Pell Grant recipients. The administration expects that more than 40 million borrowers nationwide are eligible for relief under the plan. The numbers in Iowa would represent 95% of the state's 429,200 borrowers, according to March data from the Federal Department of Education. Iowans owe a total of $13.3 billion in student debt. The average amount owed by each Iowa borrower is close to $31,000. Iowa politicians are split on forgiveness, is the next subsection. Goes on to say White House officials celebrated the plan in a call with reporters on Tuesday, saying the plan would provide upward mobility for millions of Americans. The analysis we are releasing today tells us that Biden's debt relief plan will touch working families in every corner of the country, U.S. Undersecretary of Education James Kyle said, in red states and blue states and everywhere in between states. Nearly 20 million borrowers are expected to see their debt completely erased, Kyle said. Iowa Democrats have given cautious support to the proposal, but stress that a more permanent fix for education costs is needed. Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken called the move a welcome first step in an August tweet, but he said more meaningful legislation is needed and called for investments in job training programs. Republicans have derided the move as a bailout that will transfer the debt of borrowers to other Americans who choose not to take out loans or already paid theirs off. Governor Kim Reynolds signed onto a letter with 21 other Republican governors this month calling on Biden to withdraw the plan and saying it puts the burden on lower-income Americans. Only 16-17% of Americans have federal student loan debt, and yet your plan will require their debts be redistributed and paid by the vast majority of taxpayers, the letter says. Shifting the burden of debt from the wealthy to working Americans has a regressive impact that harms lower-income families, it continues. The White House has stressed that income eligibility will be capped at $125,000, and it estimates 90% of recipients of relief make less than $75,000. Several organizations are setting up to challenge the forgiveness plan in court, according to Axios. Well, applications will be opened soon. The Department of Education is expected to open an application for borrowers to apply for debt forgiveness in early October, according to U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. Borrowers should then expect to see their loan amounts drop within the next 4 to 6 weeks. Iowa borrowers can sign up for updates at the Department of Education website. And in our final front page story, Daabin, D-A-A-B-I-N as it's spelled, opens in Mason City. Store sells overstock, return discontinued items from big retailers. It's written by Mary Loden of the Globe Gazette. Daabin store, located at 1704 South Federal Avenue, opened its doors September 10th with people lined up to check out the store, some even camping outside the night before. Daabin co-owners Jennifer and Jesse Rush passed out hot cocoa to those in line Friday evening and handed out donuts Saturday morning as well as other prizes. Our franchise location now officially holds the record for earliest customer line forming at 7:40 p.m. the night before grand opening, Jennifer posted on the store's Facebook page. Shopping at a bin store, bin, B-I-N, quote-unquote, store, is a bit like treasure hunting. Merchandise is purchased by the truckload from warehouses sight unseen and delivered to stores. The items are piled into bins for shoppers to sift through. Prices drop each day until the bins are empty. For the Bin Store, the week begins on Saturday with a mix of items such as name brand phones, gaming systems, tablets, cameras, tools, small appliances, clothing, and toys. All inventory is overstocked. Returned and discontinued items are often coming from major online retailers. None of the inventory is carried over into the next week. Bins are emptied of remaining items at the close of day Wednesday. The bins are then cleaned, sanitized, and refilled for the next week. That part is exciting for me because we are taking this stuff companies would typically dispose of, and we're putting it back into the marketplace at an affordable price point, Jennifer said. Even the unsold merchandise that gets bagged up at week's end finds a new home. The general store, One Vision's thrift shop in Clear Lake is where it ends up. But the Bin Store isn't a new idea. My husband and I are actually market tested the concept of a bin store 4 years ago in Cedar Falls, where we live, trying to figure out if there was a market for it, Jennifer Rush explained. She went on to say it was a really new concept at that point and really taking off on the coast, but in the Midwest, it seems to take a little longer for things to get here. And our market just wasn't ready for it, she said. The couple put the idea aside until October of 2021, when friends Andy and Amanda Weikers, founders of Dub Inn, opened their first store in Waterloo. When the Weikers opened their store, Jennifer said she checked it out and was amazed. I said, if you ever decide to franchise, put me on the list, because this is something Jesse and I wanted to do 4 years ago, Jennifer said. The first Dub Inn store really took off, and the Weikers began to sell franchises. We are very grateful that he and his wife gave us the opportunity to buy the franchise and the location for here, Jennifer said. We feel really blessed by that. Well, Mary Loden covers city and county government for the Globe Gazette. You can reach her by emailing Mary, M-A-R-Y, dot Loden, L-O-D-E-N, at GlobeGazette.com. Well, more page from A2. DNA match leads to arrest. It's written by Lisa Gruet of the Globe Gazette, where a North Iowa man is looking at a pair of felony burglary charges after a DNA sample turned up two hits. Police say Jesse Keenan, Raphael, age 27, of Mason City, is behind two separate burglaries, one in May of this year, which resulted in injury, and one in November of 2017. According to court documents, police took a report in May of a male who had been attacked and injured by Raphael. A sample of blood at the scene was collected for analysis. Officers interviewed Raphael, who denied his involvement, and ultimately collected a cheek swab. Raphael's DNA came back as a match to the blood at the assault scene, as well as to the scene of a break-in and theft, which occurred at a Mason City residence in 2017. Raphael was arrested on Wednesday and charged with one count of first-degree burglary in connection with the assault and one count of third-degree burglary in connection with a 2017 theft. A preliminary court hearing has been scheduled for 1:15 p.m. on Friday, September 30th. Raphael is being held without bail in the Cerro Gordo County Jail. And it shows the photo here on the right of this story, MCHS Homecoming Court. Everyone's lined up sitting on the sign, the concrete sign out front that says Mason City High School. Mason City High School announced its 2022 Homecoming Court. Pictured in this picture from left to right are Arya Sajidian, Takesha White, Eli Hardy, Olivia Schissel, Marcus Ellsburn, Zariah Cooper, Tavian Banks, Miriam Detmer, Jess Cornick, Destiny Kinaya, Caden Tyler, and Rosa Monarch. The coronation ceremony will be held Friday afternoon ahead of the homecoming game, where the Riverhawks will take on Decorah. Moving on now to more state and national news on page 3. Franken says no legal restriction on former campaign staff. Written by Aaron Murphy of the Globe Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines, where a day after political opponents argued Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken should release from legal constraints a former staffer who claimed Franken kissed her without her consent, Franken's campaign manager said no such legal agreement exists. Franken, a retired U.S. Navy admiral from Sioux City, is running against longtime Republican incumbent U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. In a Des Moines police report published Monday by the conservative website Iowa Field Report, Kimberly Strope Bogus, who worked on Franken's campaign before being fired in February, told police that after meeting for drinks at a Des Moines bar in March, a person, who is not named but presumed to be Franken based on the context, grabbed the collar of her vest and kissed her on the mouth. Des Moines police closed its investigation, and the Polk County attorney declined to open a case after determining no criminal intent was established. Franken acknowledged the meeting occurred but denied Strope Bogus's claims, telling the Gazette on Monday it never happened. In the incident report, Strope Bogus said the Franken campaign asked her to sign a separation agreement that included a stipulation that prevents her from making disparaging remarks about the candidate or his campaign. On Tuesday, Grassley's campaign spokeswoman and the Republican Party of Iowa said Franken should release Strope Bogus from any non-disparagement agreement. On Friday, Franken's campaign said no such legal agreement exists. No agreement exists that prevents any employee of our campaign, past or present, from speaking out on this issue, Franken campaign manager Julie Stotch said in a statement sent to reporters. These accusations are false and deceitful insinuations from political opponents. Well, Stotch's statement goes on to compliment Grassley for his expressed support for federal legislation that would nullify non-disclosure agreements when workers report sexual harassment and assault, and says Franken would vote for the bill in the Senate. Strope Bogus told the Gazette she is seeking legal counsel before commenting on Franken's claim that there is no legal agreement that prevents her from speaking publicly. Grassley campaign spokeswoman Michaela Sunderman accused the Franken campaign of attempting to play word games with its claim that there is no legal agreement that precludes Strope Bogus from discussing her claims. Sunderman noted that in the police report, Strope Bogus said Franken's attorneys told Strope Bogus' attorney that her reposting of social media posts about the Franken campaign originally posted by her wife were in violation of the non-disclosure that she signed when she was terminated. The question remains, will Mike Franken release his accuser from all non-disclosure agreements so she can fully share her side of the story? And will Mike Franken pledge not to retaliate against his accuser should she speak out freely regarding all her interactions with him, Sunderman said in a statement to the Gazette. Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman, in a statement, accused Franken of using intimidation tactics to silence victims. These allegations are very troubling, and Iowans deserve to hear the whole story, Kaufman said. Mike Franken has been accused of gross misconduct, and it speaks directly to his character. In other news on page A3, sanctuary cities navigate migrant influx from GOP states. This is written by Michelle L. Price of the Associated Press, Dateline, New York. There are few places in the U.S. with a more deeply ingrained reputation as a refuge for immigrants than New York City, where the Statue of Liberty rises from the harbor as a symbol of welcome for the worn and weary. But for Mayor Eric Adams, reconciling that image with an influx of migrants landing in the city, including thousands being bused there by Republican Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, is proving difficult. The city is struggling to accommodate what Adams says has totaled more than 13,000 asylum seekers, leading him to explore whether New York can ease its practices for sheltering the homeless or even temporarily house migrants on cruise ships. Both ideas have drawn blowback from liberal advocates influential in the city's politics. Adams is one of several leaders of Democrat-leaning jurisdictions facing a sudden test of their commitment to being sanctuary cities or states. The designation, in which local officials pledge to limit their cooperation with federal immigration authorities, has long proved popular among progressives pressing to ensure the government treats migrants humanely. But officials say the policy is being exploited by leaders hoping to make a political point. We are not telling anyone that New York can accommodate every migrant in the city. We're not encouraging people to send 8-9 buses a day. That is not what we're doing, Adams said this week about his request for Abbott to coordinate with the city about the buses of migrants he's sending. We're saying that as a sanctuary and a city with right to shelter, we're going to fulfill our obligation. The GOP effort began in the spring when Abbott and Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona put migrants on buses to Washington and later New York. The move was intended to draw attention to what the GOP governors deemed failed border and immigration policies under Democrats and the Biden administration. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis intensified the tactic, chartering a flight last week to Martha's Vineyard, an elite Massachusetts vacation spot. The unpredictability that Adams referenced is precisely what the governors say they're trying to accomplish. If you believe in open borders, then it's the sanctuary jurisdictions that should have to bear the brunt of the open borders, DeSantis said at a news conference Tuesday. Abbott's office has dismissed complaints and says Democratic officials should call for Joe Biden to secure the border instead of complaining about fulfilling their sanctuary city promises. Sanctuary cities or states are not legal terms but have come to symbolize a pledge to protect and support immigrant communities and decline to voluntarily supply information to immigration enforcement officials. Advocates say they are havens for immigrants to feel safe and be able to report crime without fear of deportation. Adams isn't the only leader struggling to navigate the challenge. In Washington, D.C., where Abbott has sent about 8,000 migrants this year, Democratic Mayor Muriel Bowser declared a limited state of emergency. She sought help from the National Guard, which the Pentagon denied. The D.C. Council on Tuesday voted to create an Office of Migrant Services to help asylum seekers. Democrat Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois brought in the Illinois National Guard to assist more than 750 migrants who have arrived in Chicago since late August. But officials in some Chicago-area suburbs have complained that they got no notice when dozens of asylum seekers were put up in local hotels for emergency housing. Burr Ridge Mayor Gary Grasso, a Republican, said both Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot apologized for not giving him advance notice. But Grasso's town has not been asked to provide any resources to help with the migrants, and all the hotel rooms are being paid for by the state, county, and city of Chicago, according to Pritzker's office. Tens of thousands of migrants who cross the border illegally are released in the United States each month to pursue their immigration cases, a practice that accelerated during Donald Trump's presidency and has reached new levels during the Biden administration. To avoid the time-consuming task of scheduling court appearances, the Border Patrol sharply expanded use of humanitarian parole. Migrants are released with an order to appear at a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement office. In New York City, Adams' administration has been strained by a long-standing court-ordered right-to-shelter law requiring the city's homeless services to provide shelter to anyone who needs it. Adams recently suggested regressing how the city complies with the law, but he said Tuesday he would not consider trying to send the migrants back to border states. It would be the wrong thing to do, and it would send the wrong message, he said. When I look at the large number of other communities that have come from other places to experience the American dream, what would have happened if we would have sent them back? That is not who we are as a country, he said. Moving on now to page A4 of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. From the Digest, Democrats work to pass policing bill. Dateline Washington, where House Democrats struggled on Thursday to pass a long-sought policing and public safety package as internal party differences threatened to derail legislation they hope to make central to their election year pitch. Final votes were expected Thursday afternoon. Passage would send the bills to the Senate, where the legislation's fate is uncertain. The package would increase money for local police departments, including those of fewer than 125 officers, provide aid for de-escalation training and mental health services. A priority is reducing fatal encounters between police and people with mental illness. A few progressive Democrats criticized what they said was the lack of accountability measures the party once sought after the 2020 police killing of George Floyd that sparked protests against racial injustice. Well, jobless and mortgage rates increase in the U.S., Dateline Washington, where the number of Americans filing for jobless benefits rose slightly last week with the Federal Reserve pushing hard to cool the economy and tamp down inflation. Applications for unemployment benefits for the week ending September 17th rose by 5,000 to 213,000, the Labor Department reported Thursday. Last week's number was revised down by 5,000 to 208,000, the lowest figure since May. First-time applications generally reflect layoffs. Meanwhile, mortgage buyer Freddie Mac reported Thursday that the average long-term U.S. mortgage rates jumped by more than a quarter point this week to their highest level since 2008 as the Federal Reserve intensified its effort to tamp down decades-high inflation and cool the economy. From there, we go to the briefs. Convict caught. Defense contractor Leonard Glenn, known as Fat Leonard Francis, who orchestrated one of the largest bribery scandals in U.S. military history, was arrested in Venezuela after fleeing before his sentencing, authorities said Wednesday. From there we go to abortion ban. An Indiana judge on Thursday blocked the state's abortion ban from being enforced, putting the new law on hold as abortion clinic operators argue that it violates the state constitution. Protest deaths. Clashes between Iranian security forces and protesters angry over the death of a 22-year-old woman in police custody have killed at least 9 people since the violence erupted over the weekend, according to a tally Thursday by the Associated Press. More on abortion. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists said in a letter to the White House on Thursday that a GOP-led proposal to ban abortion nationwide after 15 weeks would endanger the health of women and have severe consequences for physicians. Kamala Harris urged Democratic attorneys general at a meeting Thursday in Milwaukee to keep fighting for abortion rights. Welfare fraud. John Davis, age 54, a former director of Mississippi's welfare agency, pleaded guilty Thursday to federal and state charges in a conspiracy to misspend tens of millions of dollars that were intended to help needy families in one of the poorest states in the U.S. And then finally here, Puerto Rico, where Joe Biden said Thursday the full force of the federal government is ready to help Puerto Rico recover from the devastation of Hurricane Fiona, even as Bermuda and Canada's Atlantic provinces were preparing for a major blast from the Category 4 storm. Those bits from the Associated Press. Talking about Russia now here on page A4 of the Globe Gazette. Russia hikes political and military campaigns in Ukraine. The photo here shows some ladies at the top looking at newspapers. One lady's looking at it. The other lady looks like she's selling newspapers. A regional election commission volunteer distributes newspapers to local residents Thursday prior to a referendum in Luhansk, Luhansk People's Republic, which is controlled by Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Writing on the newspaper reads in Russian, 27.09, yes. Russia escalated its military and political campaigns Thursday to capture Ukrainian territory, rounding up Russian army reservists to fight, preparing votes expected to lead to the annexation of occupied areas and launching new deadly attacks. Russian and Ukrainian forces exchanged missile and artillery barrages on both sides and refused to concede ground. Part of a larger story here, short story, but a full story. Blinken urges Security Council to tell Moscow to end Ukraine whore. That's written by Jennifer Peltz and Matthew Lee of the Associated Press, Dateline United Nations, where the United States called on other nations, to tell Russia to stop making nuclear threats and end the horror of its war in Ukraine, as all three countries' top diplomats spoke but didn't quite meet at a high-profile UN Security Council meeting Thursday. Held alongside the annual UN General Assembly gathering of world leaders, the session followed a striking development in the war this week. Russia called up a portion of its reserves for the first time since World War II. At the same time, President Vladimir Putin said his nuclear-armed country will use all means available to us to defend itself if its territory is threatened. And all means available to us, he was referencing himself, Russia. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saw Putin's remark as particularly menacing given plans for referendums in Russian-controlled parts of eastern and southern Ukraine on whether to become part of Russia. Western nations have condemned those votes as illegitimate. But in their wake, Moscow might see any Ukrainian attempt to retake those areas as an attack on Russian territory, Blinken warned. Every council member should send a clear message that these reckless nuclear threats must stop immediately, he said. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov didn't mention his country's nuclear capacity or the new troop mobilization during his own remarks at the council meeting. Instead, Lavrov repeated his country's frequent claims that Kiev has long oppressed Russian speakers in Ukraine's east, one of the explanations Moscow has offered for the invasion, and that Western support for Ukraine is a menace to Russia. The Security Council has held dozens of contentious meetings on Ukraine since the war began in February, but Thursday's session had special stature. Regardless, no one expects the Council to act against Russia since Moscow has veto power as a permanent member. And we are at the halfway point here in the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette, brought to you on Saturday morning, September 24th. This is the September 23rd Friday edition. All material heard here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader at the microphone filling in. My name is Andrew Haupt. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, then please give us a call at 515-243-6833 or toll free from anywhere in the state, 1-877-404-4747, if that's easier for you all up in northern Iowa. We'll take a look now at today's obituaries, and we only have one, and it's a death notice. Gary Smith, age 74, of Mason City, died Monday, September 19th, 2022, at Mercy Medical Center, North Iowa, Mason City. Arrangements are with the Ewing Funeral Home. And that's it. That means we move on now to the world of sports, at least for a while. And the headline, Down Under Battle. Iowa's Taylor Rutgers-Corsack take center stage in Australian punter chess match. It was written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times. And the photo, a big headline photo, shows Iowa punter Torrey Taylor, number 9, kicking the ball during the third quarter of a college football game that happened Saturday, September 17th, last Saturday, at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City. The story is Dateline Iowa City, where Jack Campbell's responsibilities on the Iowa punt team don't allow him to savor the nuances of Torrey Taylor's work. But when he does catch a glimpse of one of Taylor's punts being downed inside the 5-yard line, Campbell enjoys the moment. It's go time for the defense when he pins one deep, Campbell said. That's when we get to go out there in attack mode. Taylor's game-altering skill has helped the Hawkeyes record a pair of safeties already this season as Iowa prepares for Saturday's 6:10 p.m. Big Ten opener at Rutgers. Field position created by two of the nation's leading punters could play a major factor in how things play out at SHI Stadium, where the Scarlet Knights have lost their last 19 Big Ten home games. Iowa's Taylor and Adam Kosak of Rutgers share more than Australian roots. Their ability to play the ball deep in opponents' territory will be among the challenges for a pair of offenses which have struggled at times early this season. Hawkeye fans who have been chanting MVP whenever Taylor trots onto the field to punt this season had a first-hand view of Corsack's abilities when Iowa and Rutgers last met in 2019. In that game at Kinnick Stadium, the Hawkeyes won 30-0, but Corsack was named the National Punter of the Week after he averaged 47.6 yards on 10 punts, including 7 that were downed inside the 20-yard line and 4 that were downed inside the 5. Michael Sleep Dalton was Iowa's punter at that time, but after arriving in the United States, Taylor reached out to Corsack, and the two Australian natives have communicated regularly since including earlier this week. I didn't expect this to happen, but with the extra year because of COVID, he is still at Rutgers, and we get the chance to be on the same field for the first time, Taylor said. He's one of my friends, so I wish all success to him as long as we kick their butt on Saturday. That's all that matters. Playing for teams that have both won games this season without scoring an offensive touchdown, both have had plenty of work through the first 3 games of the season. Rutgers at 3-0 and Iowa at 2-1, rank 13th and 14th respectively in the Big Ten in total offense, and both have needed strong punting games to get a leg up on their opponents. Taylor leads the Big Ten and ranks 3rd nationally with an average of 48.26 yards per punt this season. His 23 punts are 5 more than any other punter in the conference, and he has hit 11 punts, 50 yards or more, had 13 downed inside the 20-yard line, and has recorded just 5 touchbacks. Corsack has not had a touchback since 2019, a streak of 136 punts without sending one into the end zone. The Scarlet Knight senior All-American has punted 12 times through 3 games and has averaged 42.08 yards. No touchbacks is something I wish I could emulate, Taylor said. I know he's going to bring a lot of problems and issues for us. There are great punters in the Big Ten that we're going to face, and he's one of them. Well, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz won't dispute that. It's a real impactful thing, and this game is a great example, Ferentz said. You've got two punters that can really alter a game. We spent a lot of time trying to come out of the end zone the last time we played against this punter. Taylor finds the enthusiasm Iowa fans have shown for his work to be somewhat amusing. He sees his ability to place the ball inside the 10-yard line as a byproduct of his time spent playing Australian rules football growing up. It's something I've been doing for years, Taylor said. Everyone kind of goes crazy when I put them inside the five, but really it's not that difficult of a punt for me. Taylor prefers to concentrate on his job this week and not get caught up in the individual punting matchup. I'm not worried about that. I just want to do my job, Taylor said. I'm happy with the way things have been going. I've been able to get more hang time on my kicks, and that's something I've wanted to do. That's what I'm excited about, helping my teammates out the best I can. Well, in Iowa State Cyclone football, Cyclones prepare for measuring stick with the Big 12 opener. ISU tangles with defending champ Baylor. Rob Gray is special to the Globe Gazette and writes this. Dateline Ames, where Iowa State quarterback Hunter Decker spoke succinctly when asked to describe Baylor. Definitely a really good team, he said. Really fundamentally sound, super fast on the defense. They do things really well, and they're well coached, too. Decker's used an economy of words to describe a broad-ranging truth. The defending Big 12 champion and 17th-ranked Bears with a 2-1 record pose a distinct challenge to the youthful but surging Cyclones with a 3-0 record. That's at 11 a.m. on Saturday, today, precisely because they don't have a noticeable flaw. Dave Aranda's Baylor teams don't beat themselves. They grind opponents down with elite offensive and defensive lines, allowing speed-blessed skilled players to shine between the tackles as well as in space. I think everything's predicated on and recruited to having the ability to really run and have great speed and great tempo, said ISU head coach Matt Campbell, whose team has won 11 straight conference games played at Jack Trice Stadium. It really is about their speed, and what I think they've done such a great job in is adding physically to that speed across the board. Well, that's especially true on offense, where Baylor features four returning starters on the offensive line, including preseason All-Americans Connor Galvin and Jacob Gall. Combine that experience with the explosive playmaking ability of the true freshman running back Richard Reese, as well as the Blake Shapen-led passing game, and the Bears' offensive epitomizes the term formidable. The Cyclones, of course, welcomed that challenge. It's very exciting, senior safety Anthony Johnson said. I cherish every moment before the game and just go out there and see everybody in the jack. It's a great opportunity. It's also fraught with peril, but without risk. There's no reward. ISU has constructed its stunning 11-game home conference winning streak because it has proven it can match any team's speed, strength, or ability to execute critical plays in tense situations. The Cyclones' defense has also been more opportunistic in three games than any time in recent memory. Johnson snared his first career interception in last week's 43-10 win over Ohio, but most of ISU's takeaways have been generated by the linebacker position. Gary Vaughn forced a fumble in the Cyclones' 10-7 win 2 weeks ago at Iowa, as did fellow linebacker Orion Vance, who forced another one against Ohio. Couple those big plays with graduate transfer linebacker Colby Reeder's two interceptions and a position once peppered with question marks has once again become an area of strength. There's no egos there, ISU defensive coordinator John Heacock said. That'll allow all of that to happen. They spent a lot of time with each other. They spent a lot of time with the young kids in the room, and they've really spent a lot of time with this whole defensive unit. So credit to them. They've worked really hard. That's the bedrock. But baseline requirement for helping the Cyclones continue their Big 12 best streak of league home victories while also churning up wins on the road. Add in precision and attention to detail, and greater ambitions emerge. It's a time-honored formula that Campbell's used to bolster his team's speed, power, and aptitude for the game, and it helps explain how the Cyclones own a modern-era record streak of 5 consecutive winning seasons. We had to learn the lessons the hard way that we probably weren't ready to run with some of those teams, Campbell said about taking over the program in 2016. You look at the first year and even how we lost games, it was a shootout that we couldn't continue to shoot out with some of those teams. So I think speed and the development of speed and recruiting speed within our program was critical. Still is, of course. It's why ISU is a slight favorite against a ranked Baylor team that's won 8 of its past 9 Big 12 season openers. The talent gap isn't wide anymore, but the margin for error, as Campbell often says, remains wafer thin. I think we'll have another measuring stick of how far we've grown and where are we really, Campbell said. Well, here are some of the football matchups that happened last night in the area. I can't bring you scores because this is being recorded on Friday, but we had Decorah that had a 2-2 record at Mason City, also with a 2-2 record. Hampton Dumont Cal with a 3-1 record at Charles City with an 0-4 record. Clear Lake was at Garner Hayfield Ventura. Clear Lake with a 1-3 record. Garner Hayfield Ventura with a 0-4 record. Forest City, 1-3, was at Osage with a 2-2 record. North Union was at West Hancock. North Union with a 3-1 record. West Hancock with a 4-0 record. Newman Catholic with a 3-1 record was at North Butler with a 1-3 record. West Fork with an 0-4 record was at Lake Mills with an 0-4 record. Hopefully one of those digits goes up for one of those two teams, or went up last night, I should say. And then we have North Tama was at St. Ansgar. North Tama with a 1-3 record. St. Ansgar with a 2-2 record. Central Springs with a 2-2 record was at Denver with a 2-2 record. Riceville with an 0-5 record was at Key High with a 2-2 record. And then finally here in the area, North Iowa with an 0-4 record was at Northwood Kensett with a 1-3 record. So check out those scores someplace, just not here right now because I can't retroactively come back and tell you. we might have an indicator tomorrow, but the only live thing in the day is usually the Des Moines Register. All right, moving on to more news now in the world on page A5. Talking about Alex Jones of InfoWars fame. And on the radio, TV, everything else. A story written by Dave Collins and Pat Eaton-Robb. Jones testifies over Sandy Hook. Waterbury, Connecticut is where this is happening. Radio host Alex Jones took the stand Thursday at his defamation trial in Connecticut as he tries to limit the damages he must pay for promoting the 2012 Sandy Hook school massacre, saying that it was a hoax. More than a dozen family members of some of the 20 children and 6 educators killed in the shooting also showed up to observe his testimony in Waterbury Superior Court, which is about 20 miles from Newtown where the shooting occurred. Plaintiff's attorney, Christopher Matei, showed a video from Jones' InfoWars web show in which he called the mass shooting phony as a $3 bill and called the parents of the victims crisis actors. Mr. Jones, if someone were to falsely claim that a group of families who had lost loved ones were actors and had faked the deaths of their loved ones, that would be a horrible thing to say, correct? Matei asked Jones before showing the video. In the context, it could be yes, Jones replied. Jones was found liable last year by default for damages to plaintiffs without a trial as punishment for what the judge called his repeated failures to turn over documents to their lawyers. The 6-member jury is now deciding how much Jones and Free Speech Systems, InfoWars parent company, should pay the families for defaming them, as it's been here, and intentionally inflicting emotional distress, as the court claims. In often emotional testimony, family members have described enduring death threats, in-person harassment, and abusive comments on social media. Some move to avoid the abuse. Jones has been in Connecticut this week in preparation for his appearance. He held a news conference Wednesday outside the courthouse, bashing the proceedings as he has on his InfoWars show, as a travesty of justice and calling the judge a tyrant. He made similar comments on his way into the courthouse Thursday. This is not really a trial, he said. This is a show trial, a literal kangaroo court. The plaintiff's attorneys began by asking Jones whether he believed Judge Barbara Bellis was a tyrant and whether he calls a lot of people tyrants. Only when they act like it, he said. Jones was also asked about a page on his InfoWars site that called the trial a kangaroo court and advertisements on that page. He said the page was created by his staff, but called it a good report. He also was asked about daily profit reports. Jones said he could not answer that question, but denied he saw the trial as a marketing opportunity. On his show, he has called the trial an attack on free speech, and when asked Thursday how important he felt the proceeding was, he answered, "I think this is historic." And one note here, the photo at the top shows Alex Jones. He is wearing an open collared shirt and a suit coat. He's speaking with the media Thursday outside Superior Court in Waterbury, Connecticut. Jones testified in a trial in Connecticut over how much damages he must pay for calling a Sandy Hook school shooting a hoax. The story goes on. Jones also said that credibility with his audience is not the most important thing to him. It's crushing the globalists, he said. Bellis began the day by going over the topics that Jones could not mention in his testimony. Free speech rights, the Sandy Hook family's $73 million settlement this year with the gunmaker Remington, the company made the Bushmaster rifle used to kill the victims at Sandy Hook, the percentage of Jones shows that discussed Sandy Hook, and whether he profited from those shows or a similar case in Texas. This is not the appropriate forum for you to offer that testimony, Bellis said. Jones indicated that he understood. But the jury had to be sent out of the courtroom several times while attorneys argued about the scope of Jones' answers. You're going to get your exercise today for those of you who wear Fitbits, the judge told jurors. During the lunch break, Jones again complained to reporters about not being able to testify that he is innocent, but said he does have some regrets about the content of his broadcast dealing with Sandy Hook. I've said things I probably shouldn't have said, he added. I didn't realize the power I had, and I've seen the families, I've met some of the families, I think they're real people, but it's the media and the lawyers that keep bringing it up and misrepresenting what I said and what I did. Jones also has been found liable by default in two similar lawsuits over the Sandy Hook issue in his hometown of Austin, Texas, where a jury in one of the trials ordered Jones last month to pay nearly $50 million in damages. $50 million in damages to the parents of one of the children killed. A third trial in Texas is expected to begin near the end of the year. When Jones faced the Texas jury last month and testified under oath, he toned down his rhetoric. He said he realized the hoax allegations were irresponsible and the school shooting was 100% real. Jones' shows had portrayed the Sandy Hook shooting as staged by crisis actors as part of gun control efforts. Testimony at the current trial also has focused on website analytics data run by InfoWars employees showing how its sales of dietary supplements, food, clothing, and other items spiked around the time Jones talked about the Sandy Hook shooting. Evidence, including internal InfoWars emails and depositions, also shows dissension within the company about pushing the allegations. Jones' lawyer, Norman Pattis, is arguing that any damages should be limited and accused the victim's relatives of exaggerating the harm caused to them. Moving on to other news from the national side. New York City subway trains to get security cameras. That's written by Maysoon Khan of the Associated Press, Report for America, Dateline New York, New York. Security cameras, which are already ubiquitous on New York streets, will soon be installed in all of the city's nearly 6,400, that is, subway cars, as officials work to rebuild riders' faith in the system's safety. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority plans to put two cameras in each train car in a project expected to take 3 years to complete, Governor Kathy Hochul said Tuesday as she announced the effort at a rail yard in Queens. You think Big Brother's watching you on the subways? You're absolutely right, said Hochul, a Democrat. That's our intent, to get the message out that we're going to be having surveillance of activities on the subway trains, and that is going to give people great peace of mind. Anticipating possible privacy or civil liberties concerns, Hochul said, if you're concerned about this, The best answer is don't commit any crimes on the subway. Daniel Schwartz, the New York Civil Liberties Union's technology and privacy strategist, said expanding subway camera surveillance is worrying given the MTA's lack of transparency around its camera and software systems. Living in a sweeping surveillance state shouldn't be the price we pay to be safe. Real public safety comes from investing in our communities, not from omnipresent government surveillance, he said in a statement. New York City's subway system has more than 10,000 security cameras in its 472 stations that have played a role in solving major crimes, though the system doesn't work flawlessly. Security camera footage was crucial in helping investigators identify a suspect after a man shot 10 people on a subway train in Brooklyn in April, but the MTA system failed to record footage from cameras on the platform where the alleged gunman made his escape from a smoke-filled train. Like most security cameras now found throughout New York City, the ones installed in subway cars won't be monitored live, but Hochul said they would still be valuable as a deterrent, since people will know they are being recorded and the footage could be valuable to investigators trying to solve crimes. Even now, police routinely use footage from privately owned cameras mounted on buildings to document a suspect's movements after a crime, though they often lose the trail if someone gets on a train. The MTA received about $5.5 million in state and federal funding to purchase and install the cameras. About 200 cameras will be installed each month, with the project wrapping sometime in 2025. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, New York City's subway system had largely shaken its 1980s reputation as being filthy and crime-ridden, though complaints about overcrowding and reliability persisted. But after the pandemic emptied the system of riders, many New Yorkers began feeling unsafe underground again. Well, another short story here. Walmart and Target begin holiday early to ease inflation sting. That's written by Ann D. Inencio. I hope I'm saying that right. D apostrophe I-N-N-O-C-E-N-Z-O. D Inencio of the Associated Press, Dateline New York, where Walmart and Target plan to begin offering deals and price-matching offers earlier this year to keep up with Americans pressed by soaring inflation and looking for ways to ease the potential sting of holiday shopping. For 2 years now, shoppers have started preparing for the holidays early, but last year it was because the global supply chain had been scrambled as nations began to emerge from the pandemic. This year, experts believe it is a rapid rise in prices, also tied to pandemic-stricken economies, that will drive Americans to shop early to avoid prices that they believe could rise even further and to spread out the spending as they pay more for gasoline, food, and just about everything else. The holiday sales strategies announced on Thursday come amid what is expected to be slower holiday sales growth compared with a year ago. Alex Partners, the global consulting firm, forecasts that holiday sales will be up anywhere from 4% to 7%, far below last year's growth of 16%. The current inflation rate of 8.3% means retailers would see a decrease in real sales. Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, is also expanding the window for returns by more than a month. Gift returns will now be accepted between October 1st and January 31st, compared with last year's return window of November 1st to January 24th, the company said. Walmart, based in Bentonville, Arkansas, is offering a wider assortment of items this year with more new brands and more Walmart exclusives than a year ago, according to Tom Ward, the company's chief e-commerce officer. The company is deepening discounts on such items as toys, home goods, electronics, and beauty. It said that more than half the toys on Walmart's list of expected hot holidays toys are under $50, with many under $25, and nearly all of the toys are available to shop now or through pre-order on Walmart.com. Target, based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, said it will begin offering holiday deals between October 6th and October 8th, a few days earlier than a year ago, and it will begin price matching then, also a couple days early. Target has one of the most generous price matching offers in retail, countering offers from more than two dozen other stores that also applies to purchases at Target.com. Target plans to hire up to 100,000 seasonal employees in stores and distribution centers this holiday season, in line with a year ago. We'll take one last check of the forecast here before we get ready to close the page, close the cover, or whatever you'd say here on this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, September 23rd, the edition for Friday, September 23rd. This is brought to you on Saturday morning, September 24th. Hope you're having a good start to your day. And for today, Saturday, expect breezy and warmer conditions, those winds from the west and northwest, up to 16 miles per hour, high of 71 degrees. For tonight, a low of 48 degrees. For tomorrow, again, sunny and windy with a high of 70. If you're headed out of the state for today, expect in Atlanta a high of 81 degrees, Boston a high of 69, Indianapolis a high of 74, Minneapolis a high of 70, and Kansas City a high of 86. Thank you so much for listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette for this Friday, September 23rd edition. Have a great day, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Straight ahead.